Welcome to the...
I'm very excited to introduce my guest today, Linda Shanahan, who's the proprietor of Barefoot Gardens, which is a small-scale, community-centered farm based upon biodynamic and organic farming methods in Pennsylvania. Linda's work as a registered nurse, combined with her training in traditional herbal practice and herb production, also led to the start of Barefoot Botanicals, which specializes in medicinal and culinary herb production, as well as farm-based herbal education. So welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you.
And go ahead and tell us a little more about yourself. I just kind of gave a brief introduction. So go ahead and tell us. It sounds very exciting.
Well, so I guess I'll start with how I got into herbs. I moved from Pennsylvania after college in 1995 to Oregon for a job. And I, as much as I loved Oregon, I felt a little bit disconnected from where I was from. And I guess I was looking for a way to connect to the place. It was so different ecologically, just a completely different environment to be in than Pennsylvania. And I wanted to learn more about the plants that were around me as a way to connect. Mm-hmm. And I found an herbalist in Eugene, Oregon, Howie Brownstein, and I ended up studying with him for a few years and working with his business and learning about mostly native and wild plants in the Pacific Northwest. And I ended up working and studying with a few other herbalists in the area, Colette Gardner and Heather Thompson, and then ultimately moved back to Pennsylvania to be closer to my family again. I got married to my husband, who I met there in Oregon. We moved back here and then started a farm a few years after we moved back, in part because we felt, again, kind of disconnected. We felt that we'd lost so much of what we'd learned and loved about Oregon. We were kind of trying to recreate here, and that is living in a way that's a little bit more environmentally sound and with high quality food and, you know, all the things that you want to do to live more sustainable lifestyle. And we found that in order to do that, we kind of needed to create that community around it for ourselves. So that's how we started the farm. And then ultimately I just introduced herbs a little bit more and more into the farm. And as we were doing that, I also then got my nursing degree because I wanted to learn more about the human body. And that was a way to do that and kind of be more herbal focused, but with an understanding of Western medicine. Mm-hmm. And then I also studied with David Winston, who's an herbalist in New Jersey. So I kind of just kept studying and learning. And as I was learning, trying to figure out how to be a farmer, which was a little bit crazy. neither of us apprenticed with anyone. We apprenticed with ourselves. We were kind of figuring out as we went along. But that brings us pretty much up to date at this point, aside from my little forays into just starting to teach the community a little bit more about herbs and how to use them and trying to bring people out to the farm now to teach them what I've learned.
Nice. Well, it just, it sounds like so much is going on. Okay. So just quickly, I have to ask. So did you go to college in Oregon, or did you move to Oregon after college? Did you go to college in Pennsylvania, or?
I went to college in Pennsylvania. I went to Temple University, and then I graduated and got a position with the AmeriCorps program, which is like a domestic Peace Corps, I guess you could call it, but it's only a 1-year commitment. So I had obtained a position out there and moved for that job. And then after that, I just kind of explored different things and different ways of living. And I actually didn't stay in the field that I studied. I mean, I was a social worker, and so I stayed in that for a few years. But I ended up wanting to learn more, something that more clinically focused. And that's how I ended up getting into nursing.
Okay. Well, that sounds exciting. And then moving to Eugene, and you studied there, and then... met your husband out there. Now, is he from Oregon, or is he from Pennsylvania, or somewhere totally different?
He's from Michigan.
Michigan, okay.
So, yeah, one of the nice things about being here is that it's driving distance to Michigan. So we can hop in the car, and 12 hours we can be in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is where he's from. And we talked about living somewhere halfway in between, maybe Pittsburgh or somewhere in Ohio, but we figured it would be better to be closer to one family or the other. So we opted for Pennsylvania, in part because there's just more jobs here. And so there's just more opportunity.
Absolutely. And I know, like, when I first married my husband, I didn't realize how hard it would be to go back, like, because I'm from New York and we live in Montana, like, how infrequently I would see my family. And so, so I totally understand that. And it's good thinking to be, you might as well just be super close. Like, even when I go to New York and I go to my brother's and it's like a 20-minute drive, I'm like, why don't you live walking distance? And he just probably glares at me. I don't know if I've ever said that, but it's funny to me. I always think, like, if I ever moved back to New York, I'd move like down the block. So, but that's probably because I've been away for so long. All right. Well, so I'm excited to learn more, but I'm sure things will come out as we go through the questions. So go ahead and tell us about, like, I always like to ask everybody about their very first gardening experience. Like, how old were you? Were you a kid, an adult? What'd you grow? Who were you with? Like, tell us about your very first experience.
Well, I guess my first experience would be hanging out with my dad in the garden, because my dad was a gardener.
Good.
My dad was actually, he grew up farming. I mean, they didn't have their own farm. They had a 5-acre, I guess, farmette, you could call it, where they had a cow and a couple pigs, and they grew corn and they grew vegetables. But my dad always, in our little suburban plot, I mean, I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and we had a little suburban plot, and he would grow tomatoes and lettuce and all the different kinds of things that you would typically grow in a typical garden. Mm-hmm. And I would just eat. I would go back there and I would harvest. I remember my first memory of the garden really was bringing my parents breakfast in bed. I had to have been 4 because we moved when I was 5 from that house.
Aww.
Or like on my 5th birthday we moved. I remember bringing my parents breakfast in bed and it was a plate of cherry tomatoes.
Aw, that's sweet.
So
that's awesome.
That was really my, yeah. So I think that was my first gardening experience, was really just harvesting. And I would eat so many cherry tomatoes that my parents told me I would turn into a cherry tomato. So.
Oh, I like that. And I love cherry tomatoes. And you know, I was saying the other day that I think tomatoes are one of the hardest things to grow here because it's hard to get them ripe. But we do get cherry tomatoes do grow prolifically and they do get ripe. And they're always fun to be able to just walk by a tomato plant and grab some cherry tomatoes and pop them in your mouth for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so then just share with us, like, what does organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening mean to you?
Well, I think it's easier in some ways to be more earth friendly as a gardener than it is to be as a farmer. I think of farming, particularly the way we do farming in this country and all through much of the world with tractors and that kind of a thing, it's just, it's not regenerative. It takes away from the site, even if you're doing it organically in a lot of cases. So with gardening, you're not necessarily going there with big equipment. You're maybe turning the soil over, you know, by hand, and not creating hard pan and the kinds of problems that we're seeing with years of tractor usage. So I consider organic or earth-friendly gardening to be a regenerative practice of gardening. Like, you're actually contributing to the site and not just taking away from a site.
Nice.
And so I'd like to think that ultimately we'll be able to achieve that on our farm. We've put a lot into our soil and we've, you know, done a lot of what we can, but we aren't as good as we should be with things like cover crops. And I'd like to move more toward some organic no-till practices so that we're not turning the soil over and over and over again. But using more perennial crops, that kind of a thing. But I think of organic gardening, what the ideal is that it's a regenerative practice.
Mm-hmm.
So you're actually adding to the site, adding to tilth of the soil.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the hardest problems that we've struggled with is finding quality ingredients to add to the soil, like finding, you know, really good organic hay or straw to add, or coming up with enough manure, or certainly, you know, organic manure, or just finding those ingredients has been tough, especially the more we expand. I didn't realize when we first started, and then we had some lucky things, like they had dug up some kind of pond or something. There was like all this peat that the Forest Service had like dug up on this piece of land that we hauled dump truck load after dump truck load after dump truck load, not just to our house, but to neighbors. And like now that that's gone, and this one organic type of farm that had like manure from days back, has been sold and there's new owners there. Like, it to me, we've been struggling with finding things to add to the soil. So just my little two bits.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the answer to that is to cover crop.
Oh, wow.
I'm just more and more and believing in cover crops. And I went to a lecture this winter with a Penn State agriculture PhD student who was arguing that you can get so many more pounds per acre of organic material and added nitrogen and phosphorus and whatever else you need into a mix of the top level of soil by growing cover crops, more than you're going to get with compost. And if you add compost, you're actually phosphorus heavy. And she was arguing that some organic farms, she went around to different organic farms testing soil samples, and she found that some of the organic farms were too high in certain things because they're adding compost.
Oh.
So, you know, adding actual, you know, composted manure or other forms of composted material. So she was arguing that cover crops, if you just have seed, that's the way to go to build your soil.
Okay.
Rather than adding things like straw.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know Mike's so always wanted to grow more cover crops, so maybe we'll just have to, as a matter of fact, he's been bugging me to get like some clover seed, and that's a cover crop, right?
Yes, it's a legume which will pull some nitrogen up to the soil surface, so that would be good for you.
Mm-hmm.
For anybody, really, if you need nitrogen added.
Okay. Well, cool. Well, that's good to know that we can just kind of grow more of our own, maybe. Because he built like this little mini farm this year. We just dug a deeper well the year mm-hmm. before last. And so this is the first year we can really grow as much as we want or as much as we can produce. So he's probably going to start doing more of that. And he's got the room. He like fenced off a whole new area. And so maybe he'll put some of that in there if I get him some
more
seeds. All right. So who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques?
It was probably more, I mean, growing up in Pennsylvania, living in Philadelphia and right around Philadelphia when I was growing up, I mean, I wasn't exposed to anything quote unquote organic.
Mm-hmm.
My father was he grew up farming on area farms. That's what he did for work. And they were very conventional, and some of my relatives had farms. I mean, we were like diving around in the corn in the silos for fun, and you know, it definitely wasn't corn that was grown organically. But once I started to get older and then moved out to Oregon, and particularly, I realized that there was kind of a different way you could do things. And I realized that some of the problems that I was experiencing throughout my life, things like headaches, may have been caused by some of the chemicals that I was exposed to. So I tried to be more conscious of what I was exposing myself to. And then over time, this just became a whole way of like exposing the entire environment to, like trying not to produce or use toxic things, not just because they impacted me, but because they impact everything.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. So then how did you learn how to garden organically? Was it out in Oregon working with those other people that you were studying with out there?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. One of the teachers that I had, Colette Gardner, she actually was a big gardener. and she would take us out to her herb gardens and we would, you know, learn a little bit about her techniques and methods. But primarily, I didn't really start gardening much until probably my last year or two in Oregon. My husband and I, he wanted to garden. He was like driven to have a big garden. So we ended up turning our entire backyard into basically a production area.
Mm-hmm.
And it was small, like a tenth of an acre, but we had chickens and we grew tons of beets and carrots and all the kinds of things that you would want to have growing in your backyard garden. And when we moved back to Pennsylvania is when we really took it seriously, and we leased land. We don't own our farm, we lease it.
Oh.
And we lease 18 acres.
Wow.
So we went from a tenth of an acre to 18 acres. We started on just 3.5 acres. And so we started very small comparatively, and we started with CSA model. So we basically were figuring out as we went along. I mean, we went to conferences every year. We'd go to different farming conferences. Primarily, we would go to PASA, which is the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. They have a great conference in every February. And we, every year, would go, even before we had a farm, because we figured we'll pick up some good tidbits from people who were actually doing it. And we really did. And we were welcome there, even though we didn't know what we were doing and we hadn't really started yet. Then when we finally did start, it made it that much more... we could take the information and put it into practice, and we were that much more knowledgeable just because we had done some of those things. But we really, going to other people's farms was probably the most advantageous thing to do when you're learning and starting out.
I just think that's great advice, and encouraging people to go to conferences, like even before you have your own place, and just start talking to other people, because that's just a great way to learn. And then, so now you started on 3.5 acres. Mm-hmm. Did you start like leasing the 3.5 acres and then built up, or you just leased the 18 acres once you had your CSA going?
We leased the 18 acres because that is what we lease from a property. The owners of the property have a business on site, and they're veterinarians, and they have a dog kennel, and they have a vet hospital, and they have the remainder of the areas that are not either their personal space or the business space. The remainder is in conservation for agricultural use.
Oh.
So they kind of had to use it for something agricultural, but it was being used as a sod farm.
Uh-huh.
And they felt very uncomfortable with that, in part because sod is a very chemical intensive kind of production, and they wanted to have food produced on site if it's going to be conserved to be in agriculture. So they had put the feelers out for someone who might be interested, and we had mutual friends. So we initially didn't use the whole acreage, but because we were growing on a portion of it and we'd have some of it in cover cropping, they were okay with that,
mm-hmm.
even though we weren't producing on all of the 18. But because we have the farm business and we leased it all in one lease, I think that qualifies it all as being agricultural,
oh.
even though we're not actively uh-huh. farming at all. So.
Uh-huh. Well, that's it. And that's a great way to start and then expand as you go. And I like that whole thing. Now, can I just, like, how did you find out about that? I know that there's a website on the New Jersey. New Jersey has a website because we were looking into kind of relocating there. I was going to go to school in New York, and there was a website that I was checking there frequently that had like opportunities for people that wanted to become either farm managers or lease acres. Is there like a site like that in Pennsylvania? Or? Sorry,
there is a website called FarmLink,
mm-hmm.
and that may be. They may have it in different states as well. I know Pennsylvania has a website. I think it's Pennsylvania Farm Link, but I think that might be other states that do that, where if you're interested in leasing land, you can go on to this site and find connections to landowners.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Also, the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, and I'm sure NOFA, which is NOFA New Jersey, which is another similar organization in New Jersey. They have classified listings, which you can always look on and see if there's someone that's leasing land or has land for sale that wants to have it in organic production. We found our land. We were actually working with the Heritage Conservancy, which is a local land preservation organization, and we were hoping to lease through them, and we actually did lease land through them, a 5-acre plot. But then the site that we leased, there was a neighboring farmer who was questioning the legitimacy of their ability to lease it to us because he felt as though he had historic claims on that site. So it was really between the organization and that farmer, and we did not want to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we started working on it and we laid down manure and we started, you know, disking it, we
Ooh.
Backed out of that lease. Yeah. So sometimes when you're leasing land, you do encounter some of these, you know, bumps along the road, and you really want to be careful who you're leasing from, and you want to be sure that it's land that's not in contention, or, you know, that was kind of an unusual situation, I think. But, you know, we're really lucky that we found owners who really value what we're doing. They appreciate that an organic vegetable farm any vegetable farm is really an industry that you're bringing on site, which is, I think, a lot of people don't realize that. They want to have a corn and soybean farm that they can look out on and consider it pretty.
Really?
Because the farmer's hardly ever there. Yeah, a lot of people in our area have land that they would like to lease, but they don't really want to see you. They don't really want to see you there all the time. They don't want to necessarily see buildings put up or hoop houses put up, the kinds of things that you kind of need to grow vegetables. So you definitely, the owners have to know what they're getting into, and the leasee has to be clear on what they need. So that's kind of important when you're looking. But the people that own our land are super supportive, and we're lucky to have found them through their children attend school with our friend's children. That's how we met them.
Nice. Well,
yeah.
Lots of valuable information there. And I'm glad we went a little deeper, because that will probably help some listeners, you know, think about it, realize that that's an option out there if they don't have their own land that they could look into.
Mm-hmm.
And also just a couple of heads up about, you know, buyer beware. I forget what the Latin thing for it is, but always, you know, just really research into. And I really like the way that you were talking in the beginning about going to the conference and meeting other farmers and getting advice ahead of time and getting tips. And you know, you find once you start talking to people are always more willing to share and spread their knowledge and help other people grow things. So it's good to encourage listeners to reach out, and don't be afraid to ask questions.
I have found that the organic farming community is so open and not competitive, and really, like, I mean, even farms that are within 5 miles of us grow some of the same things are so open with us about their techniques and about, I mean, we're not competing with each other. There's enough of a market there to provide what we're providing without competing with each other so much. You know, I mean, I guess there could be a day, and I think that was maybe the case in Oregon, where there were a lot of organic farmers and maybe they were a little more cutthroat, but definitely not here. I mean, it is very, everyone is so open and supportive, and partly it may be because we are kind of few and far between. We're just supportive of each other, so it's good.
Yeah, I also kind of feel like the world is turning more towards, I don't know if I should say this, but like a theory of abundance. Maybe I think the millennials that are growing up, like the young 20-year-old, what are millennials, 20 to 35-year-olds, that their generation, I listen to a lot of podcasts and I hear more about, you know, global responsibility, social responsibility, you know, living in a world of abundance, like not being afraid to, if you hear somebody that has a business and you think, oh, I can't do that because they have it, that idea that it's just, you know, proof of concept, and don't worry about that there's plenty for everybody, and your unique little twist is going to be a little bit different, and that there's room. The more we have, the more we can share. And just, I feel like we're finally getting people to go that way instead of worrying, this is my piece of the pie, don't touch. So
I totally agree. It's interesting that you attached it with a millennial generation. I'm not a millennial. I guess a Generation Xer. But
yeah,
I appreciate
too.
That I'd be lumped in with millennials.
Yeah.
They are a positive generation. My generation is, you know, slackers. So,
I hope the world's going to change to a positive way, and they seem to be bigger movers and shakers. So that's what I've been hearing anyway. The ones that I listen to, they seem pretty on top of things and willing. And like I said, that theory of abundance, that instead of a theory of scarcity, that if I have a business, you're competition, instead of looking, you know, this one guy's always like, all ships rise in a tide or something. I don't even know what that means, but I know he's always talking about there's plenty of room for all of us, and, you know, just promote your friends, work on community. Anyway, back to Gordon. Tell us about something that grew really well this year. Was there something that grew better than you expected? And probably, I mean, last season, you know.
Well, there's two things. One is an herb and one is a flower, because I grow flowers too.
Sure.
We started a couple of years ago buying ginger rhizomes from a guy in Hawaii named Biker Dude. That's the name of his business. He produces ginger for production. farms up and down the East Coast, I guess, are now buying a lot more from them, and West Coast, I'm sure. But we were in North Carolina a number of years ago, and we met a farmer there that was growing ginger. And we were like, wow, you can grow ginger? What? So they gave us a little bit of information about where they were getting their ginger, and we started to grow it here. And last year, we dedicated half of one of our production houses. We have two hoop houses. One is propagation and one is production. And we devoted half of that basically to ginger production. And it was incredible. It was great. We love it. It was perfect. We harvested about 40 pounds every week, and we would bring that to the farmer's market, and we would sell out every single week.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great. So we love ginger, and that was actually kind of herbal, medicinal, culinary. It kind of combines everything that we're both interested in, my husband and myself. And we made ginger marmalade with it at the end of the season, and it was so incredible. It was just so good. So that was my favorite thing last year, was ginger.
All right. That's wonderful. Who was I? We were watching some video the other day, and someone was talking about ginger from Japan. And my husband was like, can you get ginger grown in the United States? And, you know,
yes.
I have never thought about growing ginger. I'm going to have to look into that. Biker dude,
yeah.
Huh?
Biker dude. Okay. You do need a long season, and we grew it under cover. I mean, we grew it not in a heated hoop house, but we grew it under the plastic of the hoops. So it required getting it in very early. We started ours all like a month ago in trays, and we're transplanting them out into the beds probably in the next week or so. So some people grow them in bags. One of the farmers near us grows them in bags, filled with a mix of soil and, I'm not sure, a coconut fiber. Maybe. I'm not sure exactly. But I know that there's different ways that people are growing them, but typically undercover.
Okay. And then did you say there was a flower?
Yeah, dahlias.
Oh, okay.
So I've been getting some more and more requests from farmers market customers and just people generally for flowers. And I've been growing them for a couple years. Actually, we've grown flowers since we've had the farm, in part because I think they're pretty and nice to have, but also because it was an additional thing we could provide to our CSA members when we felt like we didn't have enough vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a cut and come again. A lot of them are cut and come again crops, like zinnias. You can just plant, and as long as you get two plantings in a season or maybe three, you can harvest all season from those plantings. So, We've always had flowers, but we've been ramping up our production. And dahlias are something that I was always kind of curious about because I think they're amazing and beautiful, but I always considered them to be kind of expensive to invest in because you have to buy the tubers, and I couldn't find an organic source, and I just decided I wouldn't do them. But then last year I found that there was an organic supplier in Virginia. So I thought, you know, I'm going to spring for it and just buy a bunch of tubers and see how we do. So I only dedicated 100 row feet. I bought a few varieties, and I planted 25 feet of each one, and I was amazed at the amount of flowers I harvested off of those two 50-foot beds. I had so many dahlias, I did not know what to do with them. I couldn't sell enough.
Wow.
I didn't have enough of a market to sell all of them. But I also, by the end of the season, had people coming back every week asking for more, you know, oh, do you have the dahlias this week? So I thought I would experiment over the winter with pulling them up and wrapping them and putting them in the fridge and storing them over the winter. But I didn't get to it because we had a really early frost last fall.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of stuff that we lost in the field. Thanksgiving was basically everything was icy,
yeah,
which was unusual for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up forgetting about the dahlias. I can't believe that this spring they're all coming up.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah, they overwintered in our unheated hoop house in Pennsylvania where we had negative temperatures many, many nights over the winter. So it's really exciting. So I have a lot of dahlias, and I ordered more dahlias. So I had ordered them in the winter. So I'm going to have a lot of dahlias this year.
All right. Well, you're going to have to experiment on how do I find a market for these dahlias?
Yes.
All
That's
right.
Okay, though.
Yeah. How about something you would do different next year? Or you're excited to try new this season coming up.
Well, I want to plant more perennials because kind of back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, tilling and harvesting and tilling and harvesting, it's just not a sustainable way to go. I've been exposed to more permacultural principles and always thought, well, you know, I can't really do that on my farm. You know, we have to produce. But I think that I want to just focus on areas of production that are perennial. So I've planted, actually I today just planted, elderberries, quite a few. I think I planted about 100 plants. No, about 85 plants today.
Wow.
Of elderberries. Yeah, so I want to plant more of my herbal loves that I can continue to harvest from year after year. So I'm investing now in future harvests. Mm-hmm. I feel as though I should have done this before. I should have invested in some of this stuff earlier in our time here, but I'm now just getting around to it, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. Better late than never.
Right. What do they say? The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago and the second best time is today.
That's right. I love that quote.
So, all right. How about something that didn't work so well last season? Was there something that didn't go the way you wanted it to or were expecting?
Well, I guess part of the biggest thing from last year was the early frost. We lost a lot in the early.
Yep. I lost you somehow.
I don't know. I could hear you, but
oh,
you couldn't
could?
Hear me. Yeah, and I checked to see if my mute was on, but it wasn't. Well, I was talking about basil, downy mildew, we had last year, and we basically had to till under all of our Genovese basil, all of our lemon basil, all the culinary basils that we typically grow were infected with this airborne disease, and apparently this is going to be the way of basil life going forward, because once an area is exposed to it, apparently that's the way it is. At least that's what our extension agent told us. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be growing basil and just cutting it, you know, cutting the basil and then starting with a new crop, almost like you do lettuce, which is kind of sad. But that's how it is. Apparently last year, every farmer in the area lost their basil crops.
Hmm. No, because I think we got cut off in the beginning. What did you call it? Some kind of mildew?
Yeah, downy mildew. I could be mixing it up with powdery mildew. I always mix the two. But it's basically an airborne fungal disease that causes the plants to wilt and become just any kind of moisture that they're exposed to causes it to stick to the leaves, and they end up becoming kind of mildewy and they blacken out their leaves. Yeah, you just can't use the leaves. So we only got one harvest, I think, off of each of our sections of basil, and we ended up having to till all of our basil, which was really upsetting because we had invested in a lot of beds for the production of basil because we sell a lot to restaurants. Mm-hmm. But our holy basil didn't get it. All the holy basil was awesome. So I'm going to grow a lot of holy basil. Which is very good in pesto.
Holy basil?
Holy basil is, some people call it Tulsi. It's a variety of basil that is typically grown in India for it's used in Ayurveda as I believe it's a Rasayana, which a Rasayana herb is an Ayurvedic tradition, an herb that you can drink or take in every day to help stimulate mental functioning or just contribute to your overall health. It's considered almost like what we would call like a vitamin, you know, that's not the right word, but not a superfood, but basically just something that's going to nourish you. And it's not an herb that's going to deplete you over time. It's an herb that will help stimulate better health. And in the case of Tulsi, it's considered a nootropic, which is an herb that stimulates brain activity and circulation to the brain. So it's used by people practicing yoga to help them in their meditation. It's called Osmum Sanctum is the Latin binomial. And so the sanctum is, I guess, just referring to the sanctifying effect of it, or the sacred part of it. So it tastes a little bit like what we're familiar with in terms of basil, like the Italian basils, but it has a little bit more of a pungent, almost camphorous taste or flavor, depending on the variety that you get. But I've used the standard holy basil variety that you can get in most seed catalogs, Johnny's or Hi-Mowing. That's the organic seed company that we buy a lot of our seed from. And their variety, I've used it in things like pesto, and I've used it in cooking, and it has maybe a little bit more pungency, but I use it interchangeably with the other basil. So I'm happy that it doesn't get the disease.
Cool. Okay. Huh. All right. Well, that's good to know. And that's something for people to think about. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, because you never know what can happen.
Yeah.
And gardening and farming is definitely, you never know. How about something you find is easy to grow and successfully every time in your area?
I grow a whole bunch of different things, but I think that one of the first things that I teach my students that we go out and harvest is calendula. It's nice because it's really useful. It's a gentle herb. It's a little plant that only gets to be about maybe 2 feet tall max, and it's covered in orange, beautiful orange and yellow flowers that can be harvested, and they're edible, although they don't taste real great because they have a little bit of a resinous quality, but a little bit of a bitter component. But you can harvest the flowers and use them to make ointments and salves for your skin. They're healing topically, but you can also make tinctures, which is an alcohol extract, and preserve them that way and take it internally. They're a nice for GI, gastrointestinal issues that require healing to the gut. So they're good for, calendula is healing to the skin and also to the GI tract. So people that have things like leaky gut, there's a lot of people that are suffering from this for a variety of reasons. And calendula is one of those herbs that helps heal the gut if you're needing help with that. And also it's a nice lymphatic herb, so it helps with promoting metabolism of fluids through the body and helps excreting with waste. But it's a really easy plant to grow. So you can grow like 3 or 4 plants, maybe 5, and you'll have enough flowers over the course of the season. It makes you go out and engage with your garden because you have to go harvest every other day or so. You have to go out and harvest, or else your plant will no longer produce, or it won't produce as much. So you will be engaged all season with your calendula plants, which is kind of a nice thing it makes you do, I think.
Mm-hmm. We grow a lot of calendulas, so I love them. They're very pretty. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
In my climate, one thing that I do grow every year that requires a little bit of treatment, it's anything that requires treatment, like stratification or scarification. When you stratify seeds, you have to do some kind of a treatment before you plant them. Like you have to subject them to cold, or you have to subject them to hot, or you have to, do something that kind of helps break open that seed coat a little bit. Another thing is scarification, which is where you actually physically try to break the seed coat with either sandpaper or with sometimes I'll use like a cast iron pot, like one leg over another, and just gently rub them a little bit over the seeds to break the coat a little bit. So things that break open that seed coat, sometimes it's a little bit harder to be successful with that kind of a process than if all you had to do was open the seed pack and then stick it in the soil. So things that I've had some problems getting started are hibiscus, which does require a little bit of a long season, so it might be hard to grow where you are, but I can grow it here. This year I had to scarf, I scarified all my seeds as I always do, but I only had a couple germinate. So that's one of those things that I don't know if it's year to year, seed packet to seed packet, but I've had a little bit of problem with germination on that. Lavender is something that grows well here, but I would suggest you just get it as a cutting as opposed to starting it from seed, because the germination rate on that, lavender and rosemary both, is very low. There's certain herbs that anything that requires a pre-treatment, I would steer new gardeners away from.
Cool. I didn't even know. I've never even heard of any doing any of that scarifying and what was the other thing that you said?
Stratifying.
Stratifying a
Yeah.
seed.
Yeah.
Interesting.
A lot of herb seeds require that kind of a thing, and I guess that's mostly the vegetables. Mostly what we grow as vegetables are otherwise kind of weedy plants. I mean, they'll grow pretty easily no matter what you do with them. But some of the herbs that we use medicinally, they do have very particular, niches that they need to fit into, or very particular environmental condition you have to subject them to in order to get them to germinate.
Interesting. Okay. Well, good to know. I think I've probably always just bought lavender plants or any kind of thing like that. I've always just bought the plants. Well, we've grown echinacea and the calendula, like I said. I guess there's a few that he's, but nothing that I know of that he's had to break open the. You say the coat? You mean like the seed shell? I guess. Is that what you mean?
And
Okay.
even echinacea, I mean, usually it's recommended that you refrigerate like the echinacea purpurea seed for about a week before you plant it. And if you get it in the ground soon enough, you don't really have to do that because just being outside, it's gonna cold treat it. It's like the cold treatment you're giving it is just putting it out early. So it
Oh.
just depends on, what the instructions are.
What activity is your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there something you have to force yourself to get out there and do?
Yeah, steak tomatoes.
Oh.
Staking.
Okay.
I
How about
mean,
your
I guess it's okay, but
Nope, that's good. How about your favorite activity to do in the garden?
I like to harvest roots because I like to see what's under the soil that I haven't been able to see while it grew.
Like, give us an example.
At the end of the season, maybe October, I harvest my valerian, and I'm always amazed. Valerian is a plant that is used oftentimes for helping people that have problems with sleeping. It's a plant that grows throughout the season. You start it early, and it has a lot of green leafy growth on top. Almost, it reminds me kind of celery or a plant like that. It doesn't look like that exactly, but it has a similar look to it. And you're watching it grow all season, and then in the fall, when I harvest it, it's very aromatic. So I'm pulling the plant, and I'm smelling it as I'm pulling it out of the ground. And then when I clean off the roots, there are these beautiful white roots that are left behind after you clean all the dirt off. I just love to see the transformation from the seed to this beautiful plant with these amazing glistening white roots that come out when I'm finished. And I just like I love the aromatic part of harvesting herbs. And so that's just one that I love. And so I love harvesting because I love to
Cool.
smell it and taste it and see it.
Oh, I like that. All right, tell us about the best crop that you ever grew. Was there one year something grew so well it was just totally prolific? I mean, I guess maybe your dahlias.
Well, I
What
guess
do you think?
the dahlias last year, but my most favorite thing that I ever grew, it wasn't an herb, it was a variety of corn called Floriani Red Flint.
Ooh.
I experimented a few years ago with trying to grow some grain crops, and I grew three different varieties of corn, and one of the varieties, Floriani Red Flint, which is a red corn that's typically used to grind up into polenta. And it's so beautiful. You harvest you pull those in the ears, and they're these beautiful, deep, burgundy red ears. And they grind up into this amazing, beautiful, yummy polenta. And I was so proud of myself for having produced my own corn that we shared with so many people. And I brought it to a friend who's a chef who made it, and he never experienced what it was like to freshly grind corn and make your own polenta from the corn that you just ground up, I don't think, or a variety like that. And he was so excited about it. So I'm going to be growing more this year. But that was a few years ago, and I think that was my happiest gardening moment, was harvesting those ears of corn and having the beautiful grain to share with others.
I'll bet the listeners are smiling because I'm smiling just listening to your story, and I'm picturing that chef in his kitchen just getting excited about it. And I like to tell this story about 1 year I was really sick, and Mike had just harvested some corn. Like for us, I think there was like 4 ears, you know, we got for the season. I mean, it was, you know, very tiny first corn crop or something. But he cooked me, he somehow fed me the liquid that the corn, you know, the broth or whatever mm-hmm. you would call it. And it was like some kind of chicken noodle soup instead, to like, I always call it the corn soup or something, that just nursed me back to health. It was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I always like tell people that story. It was just incredible. So
did he have,
cool.
Did he have any, yeah. I mean, there are components in the corn ears. When you're pulling off the ear, there's the silky hairs that are inside that we, the silk that we take off, that's used medicinally.
Oh, I had no idea.
So, yeah, so that the silk inside the ears is used as a urinary tract demulcent, meaning that it helps provide like a slippery, slimy, and slightly antibacterial effect that when you digest it and metabolize whatever components are in that, and it excretes through your urinary tract. So there's a slimy, mucilaginous quality to it that you pee out. So if you have a tendency or have an active urinary tract infection and you have irritation or burning, that the components of that silk help heal as you're actually peeing it out. So I'm sure that there's some of those components too that are healing and nourishing and mucilaginous in other parts of the plant. So maybe that's one of the reasons it made you feel so good.
Maybe. I just remember it was like a miracle broth. It was just incredible.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he probably pulled the silky hairs off though, because he's kind of picky about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. No, probably wasn't in your soup.
Nope. I just curious. Like, would you cook those silky hairs, or you just mash them up and eat them, or?
You can make a cold infusion with them, which is basically just soaking them in water, and then the mucilaginous quality can come out. Or I usually make a tincture with them. I just tincture the fresh silk in a low percentage of alcohol. So I usually buy grain alcohol, and then I add water to make it the percentage of alcohol that I want. So depending on what I'm extracting, I decide on how high of a percentage. So for things that you're trying to get a mucilaginous quality from, you want to add a low amount of alcohol, because the alcohol denatures the mucilage. So I would just make a low alcohol extract and then use that in, you know, by the teaspoon or however much you need for whatever the situation is.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay. How about the best gardening advice you have ever received?
When we were first starting out, one of the farmers in the area who was really encouraging, who totally knew what he was doing, and they're amazing growers, my friend Tom Murtha, with Blooming Glen Farm, his wife Trisha Bornman, they have a great CSA a little bit north of us, and they were like rock stars. You know, they're so good. They're doing this, they're doing that. They have a million CSA members and they managed to do it all. And we're like, we don't even know how to grow like tomatoes hardly, you know? I was really worried. I don't remember what it was I was worried about, but I tend to worry about my plants. They're like my children in my greenhouse. Like, they're going to be dead tomorrow. I have to go check on them. And I commented about one of my fears about something. I don't know what it was, but it was when I was, you know, the first year or two that we were growing. And he said, just remember, plants, they just want to grow. They just want to grow. So it really, every time I get worried or get upset or think about the fact that, oh my God, we need more rain, or oh my God, this, or whatever, I just think about that conversation where he reassured me that it's okay. I mean, they just want to grow. You can really abuse them and they still most times will pull through. And he's right.
Nice.
It's proven right over and over and over again.
Hmm. Nice. Good to hear.
Yeah.
How about a favorite tool that you like to use? Like, if you had to move and can only take one tool with you, what would it be? What could you not
I do? Love my little hand hoe. I use a little hand hoe. So I tend to like to be more hands-on with my weeding. I as much as I love to use my wheelhoe and run down the aisles with my wheelhoe, I like my little DeWitt hand hoe. It's my favorite tool, and when one wears out, I get another one.
All right. Okay, so the next question is about eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time. I always have a hard time just, you know, picking everything and then getting it cleaned and getting keeping it in the fridge or anything. Got any tips for that?
Have enough people helping.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, there's always stuff that we don't get done every day. There's stuff that really should be done that we just didn't get done or get harvested in time for market. An example is the asparagus. The asparagus kind of got away from us, and now it's all starting to flower. So once you don't, if you don't stay on top of it, it doesn't like keep producing for you. So, I mean, one of the things is to just be ritualistic about it. Calendula is a perfect example. I have to make sure I set aside 2 hours every other day to harvest, or else it will stop producing. So either myself or I have to have a dedicated person to do it, and try to just have it be ritualized into the daily routine. And that's really, I find, the only way when you're managing so many different crops to get it done. If you have a small garden, just ritualize your time in the garden. You know, don't just figure sometime in the next weekend or two you're going to get to it. You know, every night or every other night, make sure you set aside an hour to go out to your garden and get to know it. And, you know, the best fertilizer is a farmer's or a gardener's footsteps. So, cool. I know somebody said that. And so just going out into your garden every day or every other day is really the best way to stay on top of it.
Okay. Cool. And I think that's what I'm just going to have to do, is like bite the bullet and say it's just for the fall. It's like for a month or two, and you just got to like dedicate this time to it. Doesn't matter how tired you are or how long your day has been. I'm just going to have to be more on top of it. How about secrets for preserving food or making it last at all? Do you do any canning or dehydrating or anything? Or you dry
we
herbs?
Do.
Maybe you want to share that with us?
Yeah. So a couple of years ago, we decided to make an investment for our farm, and we bought a shipping container that we converted into a drying unit. Ooh. So we outfitted the shipping container with fans and a small heater, and we have a friend who's a carpenter, and he kind of just helped with building these racks all throughout it with a stainless steel mesh frames, and we basically now can harvest tons of product at a time and dry it. And that's been awesome, because now I'm selling peas at the farmer's market every week of stuff that I otherwise couldn't sell because I didn't have any way to preserve it.
Nice. Now,
so,
you said teas? You make teas?
Yeah, so I grow chamomile and the holy basil that I was telling you about, oats. I grow oats and harvest them in the milky stage, and people drink that as a tea or use it as a tincture. So some of the plants that I grow, lemon balm is another example. Some of the plants that I grow for either culinary use or herb use, medicinal use, or just pleasure tea, you know, lemon balm, chamomile, those kind of nice gentle teas. Then I bag, you know, process them by what we call garbling in the herb world, where you break off the stems after they're dried, break off the stems and kind of clean them so that it's just the leafy material or the flowers, and then package them up and bring them to the farmer's market, and people love them.
Mm. Wow. You're just full of knowledge and things I've never heard of. Now, let me ask, how big is your farmer's market? Like in my town, Eureka, where we're going, we're having a really hard time just having any kind of a farmer's market. And now the biggest growers and CSA farmers have just recently moved. So I hear people already are fearful that this year it's just going to completely fall apart. But how big is your farmer's market?
Well, it's one city block. They block off the road on either side, so the road is closed down. And then basically it's a line on either side of the street of vendors. And so I think we have about 28 or 30 vendors.
Oh, uh-huh. That's quite a pile.
I mean, there's a one, and ours is actually kind of, I think, smaller than a lot of the other farmers markets that are around. Mm-hmm. The oldest market in the country is in Easton, which is about an hour north of us. And that's a pretty big market. I think it takes up a big chunk of the downtown. And then there's Philadelphia markets, which they have a number of very big, you know, markets. But the farmers market movement is pretty big here. There's a few very well-established markets, and we have a couple anchor producers. So it sounds like you may be losing your anchor, and that we would call the anchor the big produce, someone who's a big produce vendor who's going to bring a lot of vegetables that will bring people to the market. We have a conventional farmer who's kind of fills that role, and we kind of fill the role of the, you know, organic-y kind
oh,
of
really?
Farm. We're not, yeah, I mean, we're, yeah. we're a lot of people know that we are the one that doesn't use chemicals, and they're the ones that do, you know, so we don't produce as much as they do by any stretch of the imagination, but we've gotten feedback from people that, you know, they go to us for knowing that their lettuce is going to be organic or,
I bet.
You know, no chemicals applied, so. So yeah, if the other farmer that's a very big farm, if they dropped, we would definitely lose, the whole market would lose quite a few customers because a lot of people come there to do a lot of their shopping for, they've been coming for 30, you know, 25 or 30 years to this market. So people have a relationship with them. And if they stopped coming, I think the market would definitely suffer.
Wow, that's interesting to know. Now, like, so then I'm also curious, like, people-wise, like, I mean, like, 100 people or, like, 500 people or 20 people? Like, our market probably gets 20 people.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, I mean, it's like, hundreds, you know, if there's, like, you know, yeah, it's tiny.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to know, like, I don't have a frame of reference to really understand how to quantify it, but I can tell you that there's two of us that run our market stand, and we barely have time to talk to each other the entire time that we're open because we're so busy. We open at 7 a.m. and maybe the first half an hour there's maybe 10 or 15 people that come through, but by 9 o'clock there, we have a line of 8 to 10 people sometimes.
Oh my goodness!
Waiting to make their purchase. Yeah, we're busy. Yeah, it's a busy market.
Ooh, cool. Okay. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, that sounds exciting.
Yeah.
How about any special techniques for cooking any weird or unusual foods? I know you're going to dazzle us with this, or some kind of like herbal thing. Or.
Well, I was going to suggest that people try making that ginger marmalade, like find a marmalade recipe, a ginger marmalade. I want to say that I obtained my recipe off of Epicurious, which is kind of one of my go-to, I think, on the internet. If I'm sure everybody has their favorite internet place to go to, and maybe it dates me a little bit, but Epicurious was one of the first sites that had a searchable, you know, recipe listing. So I've just always gone to them. But I really loved the ginger marmalade recipe that I found. But weird and unusual is, I guess, more herbally. I love turmeric, which is a common ingredient in curries and different foods that have that orangey color that you may see in sauces. And I like to drink it as a milk-based drink. So I saute a little bit of ghee, and then I add some chai-like spices, maybe a little ginger and cinnamon and cardamom. And then I add a little bit of turmeric to that and kind of wait till it's aromatic. And then I add milk. And then I heat that up, strain it, and maybe add a little maple syrup for sweetness. And then I drink that as kind of a yummy, warming, anti-inflammatory beverage. I love it in the winter. I love it in the summer. It helps with my pain. It helps with general detoxification. It's just a great, yummy, pleasurable thing to drink. And I think
you were going to dazzle us. That sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's so good. I've heard it called golden milk, and I think some herbalists have listed recipes. If you look up golden milk, you can find that. It may be a little bit strong, some of the recipes, but you can just kind of play around with it. You don't have to add that much turmeric. But it's so good, and it's so good for you.
Okay.
You don't have to use regular milk. You can use any kind of milk.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it just sounds delicious. How about, so then is that your favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden? Or do you have like another one?
Well,
Which
I
those
mean,
two are both
basically
I
I
knew.
roast. A couple years ago, my husband just kept talking about a grill, and I maybe it's a guy thing. I don't know. But he wanted a grill, so we got a grill for his birthday, and roasting vegetables on the grill is awesome. We cook so many more vegetables now. I'm so glad we
Oh.
got the grill.
Cool.
Yeah,
Okay,
so
that
we
sounds
just
perfect.
roast a lot of veggies. Yeah. And making
Ha.
pesto with all different kinds of things. Sorry, go
Oh,
ahead.
I am so excited to try that. Especially, I have like oregano going out my kazoo, and I've been looking for a good something to do with my oregano. I've been asking neighbors for years. And then since I've started this podcast, you're like the fourth person to say, you can make pesto out of things besides basil. So one of these soon days, I'm going to get down there because I have enough to harvest and probably make enough pesto to feed everybody at the farmers market and all of downtown Eureka right now already. I mean, I have oregano, so much of it. So I'm ready to try oregano pesto. How about a favorite internet resource?
Well, if we're talking about recipes, I guess it would be Epicurious.
It
I
doesn't have
like
to be about, it
Epicurious.
could be like gardening or any kind of internet resource. But that works.
Yeah, I don't know. There's so many different sites. I have to think. I guess when I was thinking about it, automatically comes to me to think about food related items. But I'd have to think. I mean, there's different. I do for herbal information. There's Henriette. There's a herbal. It's like a combination blog slash informational powerhouse. She has books and things that have been scanned and posted online, and it's Henriette's Herbal. I can't tell you exactly what the
Okay.
link is, or but something like that. And she has, I think it's Henriette Kress perhaps that does it. I can't remember her if that's her name, but she has this amazing resource online for lots of herbal information. And if ever I'm not sure about something, or someone asks me about whether they should do this or that, I will sometimes get a second source of information online through her site.
Cool.
But I
That's
don't
perfect.
generally don't like online sources for herbal information, but
Okay.
hers is good.
How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine that you can recommend?
I love Orion, that periodical journal. It's a kind of a literary, environmental, philosophical, bi-monthly, I think it's every other month, magazine. And I just like to look at the amazing photography, read the poetry, read sometimes what is kind of a philosophical approach to the environment, maybe in an essay. They just kind of have all different kinds of things, and generally the focus is environmental sustainability, and it's but a more artistic slant. So I like that magazine. It's Orion, Orion.
Cool. All right, I'll have to check that out. I've never heard of that. And
Yeah.
I'll find that Henrietta's Herbal, or maybe you can send me the link and I'll put that in the show notes. So if
Oh,
listeners
okay,
want to look that
sure.
up.
Yeah.
How about so any business advice for listeners about, I mean, you've shared a lot, but just like any final words on business advice if somebody was going to start their own farm or herbal business or anything?
Yeah, something that my husband says all the time that I think is totally applicable to any business is small steps, small mistakes. Big steps, big mistakes. So whenever you're embarking on something, don't go too crazy at first. I mean, it takes so much more work than you think it's going to take. So much more work. So just start
For
small, and
sure.
it makes it a lot easier to start small.
Cool.
And supporting
Perfect.
local businesses is a great thing too. Like other local businesses have been so supportive of us, and we try to be supportive of them in return.
Nice. Okay, so the final question is, if there was one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either in your local area or on like a national or global scale?
Well, I guess a local issue that's reflective of the global issue is Pennsylvania is a hotbed of fracking. Mm-hmm. If people aren't familiar with fracking, it's basically they go in with machines and they break open the rock and sediment with chemicals to extract natural gas from deep in the earth. And one of the resulting consequences of that is, for one, the destruction that has to happen in the process, the actual process of it, of everything that's on top of the wells that they create, but also they have lagoons of the water that they've had to use to extract, and have waste. They have chemical waste,
exactly.
Water, mm-hmm. Yeah, from the production process, and it's just representative to me of our wrong direction of over dependence on fossil fuels. So I guess that we all benefit. I'm talking on a phone that's been made with, you know, products that are
right.
Benefit of mining and of the petrochemical industry. We all benefit, but we also have to be cognizant of the fact that we overuse, and perhaps we could try for other alternatives, solar or whatever else. I mean, that everything uses resources. We just breathing, we use resources. We eat, we use resources. But I think that we have to be more, I mean, it's the same conversation everybody's having, but
everybody's having it.
Well, I guess not everybody's having it. I guess the biggest thing to me is trying to somehow, in whatever way we can, reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. And, just driving around and all the things that we do every day, it all uses resources. And even just being aware of your use of resources is a step in the right direction. You don't
Absolutely.
Necessarily have to change your life upside down. Just be aware of your choices. And it is about choices.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Nobody else has talked about fracking. And I just talked to a friend the other day, was like, what's fracking? And I just go, okay. No, it's so important. And the water that's used for fracking, and just, you know, it's all these little conversations that will help. So, no, thanks for bringing that up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how about an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
I guess the biggest thing for me, and I would hope that this transmits to other people, is the garden is a way for me to connect with the energies of the greater environment around me. So the changing seasons, the changing temperature, the changing humidity, all those things that are going on around us that our bodies are reacting to, maybe subconsciously, it brings you into the conscious mode of reacting and also working with. Which then develops, I think, a more deeper spiritual connection to the environment and the earth around you and under your feet. So I feel as though, for me, it's kind of like a spiritual practice to connect and to be healthier, both physically and spiritually. So that's what I would, that's why
Very
I would
nice.
Say get into gardening.
I like that. I always feel like when I go for a walk in the woods, that's like my church. And being
yep.
my place to be closer to God and the world and just appreciate the beauty. And I love to get out. And now we have our big garden. Well, thank you so much. You have really shared a lot. I like the way that you really went into explaining things in depth for people and really talking like the individual steps and, just different aspects of the whole gardening process and farming and herbs. And you've just shared a lot of knowledge with us today. So thank you so much, Linda. Do you want to tell listeners how they can connect with you if they're interested?
Yeah, I have a website. It's mm-hmm. well, we have two websites, barefootbotanicals.net, mm-hmm. and the other is barefootgardens.farm, F-A-R-M.
Okay.
And our email and contact information is on both of those sites.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. And the links to all those will be in the show notes for listeners if they get to our website. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing your knowledge with us today, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks for having me. It was an honor.
Oh, thanks. How would you like to win a copy of one of my all-time favorite gardening books, Rodale's An Ultimate Encyclopedia of Organic Gardening? If you enter our 2015 Gardening Challenge by going to our website at awesomemontana.com and clicking on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener podcast, right on top, there's a link to the Gardening Challenge where you can fill out a simple form. It just asks your name, the number of people in your household, what vegetable, fruit, or flower you're choosing, how much you plan to grow, and where you live. You can always email me at organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com. There's no spaces, all lowercase, organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com. And just send me the information there too. Our goal is to help listeners be inspired to grow enough produce to feed your household for a year, or at least, you know, supplement your produce bill a little. So since our first challenge this year, we're just encouraging you to pick one fruit, a vegetable, or a flower, just one, that you would like to grow enough of for your household for 2 to 3 months, like for a season. Since it's a little late, we thought just, you know, 2 months, if you pick lettuce, you might, you know, it always depends. So something that you want to grow, 2 or 3 months worth, you know, kind of figure out how much would you buy if you went to the store? Would you buy a 2-pound bag of carrots every week? Or would you buy, you know, a 10-pound bag of potatoes every couple of weeks? Or, you know, if you're picking flowers, you might think about, you know, a bouquet. You know, what do you want? Like enough carrots to feed you and your kids, or enough salad to have to eat every day for the month of July, or, you know, enough zinnias to have a fresh bouquet or two on your table each week? You know, whatever it is that you'd like to grow for a season, let us know and you'll be entered to win a copy of Rodale's Ultimate Encyclopedia of Gardening. And then I just want to encourage you, if there's anything we can do to help make your garden journey easier, more successful, if you have any questions, if you just want to share your challenges or successes, we would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback for the show, somebody, a guest you'd like to hear from, or a topic you want to learn more about, you know, please, you know, let me know. Any honest suggestions that we can implement are always appreciated. Just, you know, let us know. Who are you? How do you like the show? You know, what can we do? We'd love to hear from you. Again, you can always email me at organicgardenerpodcast@gmail.com, or just reach out to the contact form on the website. Thank you so much for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast today.